You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, did you used to play pinball as a kid? Or maybe you still do as an adult? We're going to talk to a pinball fan and hear about some hot spots here in Wisconsin. Now, the FDA last week granted emergency authorization to Pfizer and Moderna's COVID vaccines for children under 5 years old, infants as young as 6 months old. It's been a long road with some hiccups along the way, but a study in May found that only a fifth of parents with kids under five are going to get them vaccinated as soon as they possibly can. We have a pediatrician and infectious disease expert here with us to answer your questions about the COVID vaccine for kids under five, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent of a kid in this age group? Have you been eagerly waiting for the vaccine? Do you plan on getting that shot as soon as possible? Are you, like many people, in a wait-and-see moment? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. James Conway is the Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a Pediatric Infectious Disease Specialist at UW Health. Dr. Conway, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
It's been a long road to get to this vaccine for younger kids. Can you talk about why this took so much longer than the grown-up versions?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated process to really figure out, you know, exactly what the right thing to do is. And, you know, I think when we always look at these vaccines, there's two sides to the coin. You know, is it safe and is it effective? And I think the biggest thing that needed to be figured out was understanding the side effects in the older individuals and then figure out how do you mitigate those, how do you minimize them and still give enough immune protection that you actually get effective protection against these things. And it took a little while to make sure we understood everything on the adult side. You know, as a pediatrician, I was sort of happy that adults were going to be the guinea pigs for a change. And we've really kind of worked out all the details and then been able to move these clinical trials forward.
And health-wise, kids are not just small adults. It's not just a matter of dividing by the number of their body weight and giving a smaller dose. What did we end up with for how these doses work?
Yeah, so for the Pfizer vaccine, we're actually going to be able to get away with 1/10 of the dose, but it's going to be given over 3 doses. So the adults and most other age groups, 2 doses seem to be enough to really prime the immune system. And I think people may remember back in February, March, Pfizer was originally starting to think that they might have enough data to submit, but it really didn't look like that very, very low dose was enough with 2 doses, and so they then continued those studies with a 3rd dose. Moderna's coming in with 1/4 of the adult dose, so 25 micrograms as opposed to 100 micrograms for the adult priming doses. And so with that little bit bigger dose, they're able to get away with 2 doses, at least preliminarily. Now, we still anticipate that there's going to be the possibility of boosters eventually, the way we've had to add them for older individuals, but right now, 3 doses at 1/10 the dose for Pfizer, 2 doses, 1/4 of the dose for Moderna.
One reason I think a lot of parents are giving for not jumping in right away is, well, wait, we've heard younger kids are the least vulnerable to COVID. Can you talk about the need, how much concern there is about these younger kids getting COVID, the impacts it can have on them?
Yeah, I think the first year of the pandemic, we kind of fooled ourselves. We were so good at mitigating and protecting the kids. I mean, we closed schools, everybody was masking, kids were in bubbles. And so I think that there was sort of a false narrative that kids just don't get this infection. As soon as we released them back into the wild of schools, even with masks, we saw a pretty rapid spread of the disease. And, you know, some of the estimates from CDC surmise that as many as 3 out of 4 kids may have had it. I think the other part, though, is that people don't see as many of the kids that we do that actually are suffering more severe consequences. So, you know, you're much more likely to die from COVID than you would be from influenza or something else that's a similar virus that circulates. But we've seen, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of kids that have gotten sick, and many, many of them ended up hospitalized. And now we're starting to see some of the sequelae. You know, we're seeing some of these kids now with long COVID. We're starting to see kids that have what seem to be permanent problems with their lungs and even neurologic issues. So I think that as more and more kids are getting infected as the remaining vulnerable parts of the population, we're starting to learn that they are actually vulnerable to occasionally having bad outcomes. The other is that these viruses are unpredictable. They keep changing, and I think as they keep changing, they unfortunately do still present some potential threat as we move forward. And so I think that's the biggest reasons that we've argued that kids deserve the equal opportunity to be protected, just like their older siblings and parents.
Talking to Dr. James Conway, pediatric infectious disease specialist at UW Health, associate director for health sciences at the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison, looking at the newly approved COVID vaccines for kids under 5. You can join in if you have a question, a comment about that. You want to share your decision-making process if you're a parent of a kid in this age group? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, you mentioned safety and effectiveness. Let's start with effectiveness. What do we know about how much benefit these kids will get from these vaccines?
Yeah, it's been an interesting process because what was done is really what we call bridging studies, where they've looked at the immunogenicity, you know, basically how much antibody kids have developed, and looked at basically how much antibody the adults develop, and essentially we're shooting for a dose that gave that kind of similar immune response. Then you kind of see how people do once you've gone back out into society. And so that they've shown that these are moderately protective against getting any infection. So I think everybody's now familiar with the term breakthrough infection. And so we do see that these kids can still get infected, although much less than those that are unvaccinated. But what we haven't seen is any of these kids that have been immunized getting hospitalized, ending up in the ICU, or any of the severe consequences. And I think that's really where we're primarily directing our attention with all of these vaccines now, is they're really designed to protect against the most severe outcomes. If they also protect against any infection, great, but they're never going to be 100%.
With the different variants, the latest Omicrons going around, how much of that moving target problem for vaccines, whether we're talking for kids or grownups?
Yeah, I think it's a major problem. And I think that we've, you know, currently temporized things by continuing to add booster doses using the original strain, get people's immunity up enough that it actually can protect them against some of these newer strains. But ultimately, really what we need is more focused vaccines directed against the actual pathogens that are circulating right now. You know, we've gotten very good at it with influenza, where we update the vaccines every year and change the strains, and we're going to have to do the exact same thing. We're starting to see now many of the companies working on these Omicron-specific boosters that are directed against those newer strains, and I think that's really where we're going to need to go, is the ability to quickly modify the vaccines, and the regulatory folks are going to have to figure out how do you actually make sure, again, that they're going to be safe and work the way they're supposed to, and at the same time update them as necessary.
All right, so that's effectiveness. Now, safety. Can you talk about the safety testing that went into these vaccines for kids?
Yeah, these were multi-center trials, so these were done all over the place. You know, the FDA made a clear edict early on in the pandemic, which I think was really a positive thing, that we really needed to approximate what the rest of the population looked like. You know, we can't continue to do things the way we used to and test them in healthy white males and then eventually get to other populations. So we've been very inclusive in making sure that we had a good idea about how these acted in all portions of the population. And what we've seen at those very low doses of the Pfizer vaccine, really very minimal side effects. Moderna's got a little bit more, as you would expect, with a little bit higher dose. So about a fifth of the kids end up with some fever. Most of the kids will complain a little bit that it hurts at the injection site. They don't complain nearly as much as the adults do because they're used to getting these kinds of things. But it really very little in the way of other complaints. Occasional, you know, aches and a couple of kids complaining of headaches, but really nothing significant at these very low doses.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Madison. Joe, hi. Joe, are you there?
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I guess the question I had, or comment, I was listening to NPR this morning, and they had a doctor from Yale and another gentleman, and I'm sorry, I don't remember where he was from, but they were discussing this exact same topic, and the one doctor made the comment, he said that like 95, 96% of the people that were infected with COVID this year were over the age of 40. And he said when it came down to the younger kids, it was like less than a tenth of a percent that were actually hospitalized. And I know the pediatrician just said before that all the kids that were hospitalized. So I guess what is correct? I mean, he was saying it was yes, kids were getting infected, especially when they went back to school, but it seemed like a lot of them had very minimal side effect and were not hospitalized.
I gotcha. Joe, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Cowan, let me try this out and see if I'm understanding you correctly. Joe's point is right if we compare the impact on adults of COVID versus the impact to kids. The adults are getting it worse. So they're more likely to be hospitalized. But if we look at the younger kids and say how they're affected by COVID versus how they're affected by, say, influenza, COVID for them is way more dangerous. It's going to put more kids in the hospital than a lot of the other diseases we're familiar with that. Did I hear you right? Is that about right?
Yeah, no, you're both right on the nose. And Joe, you know, it's absolutely correct that, you know, this is a disease that is certainly more devastating the older you are, or the worse your immune system is. And so kids are fortunately younger, healthier, and in general have better immune systems. I think one of the things we have to recognize is there's a pretty large population of kids that actually don't fit that paradigm, that actually do have underlying medical conditions. And those are the kids that, you know, largely suffer the worst. But again, these things are unpredictable. You know, of the 400 plus kids that have died from this, you know, more than half of them were totally normal, healthy kids. And so I think that's the thing that, you know, if it's your kid or if it's your family that's affected, you know, you don't want anybody else to ever have to deal with this. And so that's the sort of, I think, spurious logic is just because it's not as devastating doesn't mean that it's not still devastating to some portion of the population. And again, you know, countless thousands, if not millions of parents have been clamoring to be able to feel comfortable that their kids can go out, lead a much more normal life, get back in with their regular friends and family, and be comfortable that those kids are really going to be at minimal risk for having any of these unfortunate and all the rare, not unexpected negative consequences.
Joe, thanks a lot for calling in. We are talking to pediatric infectious disease specialist Dr. James Conway from UW-Madison, looking at the newly approved COVID vaccine for young kids and infants. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you making that appointment for your kid now that these are available? Have you already gotten that shot for your kid? Or are you watching and waiting if you're a parent of kids in this younger age group? If you work in healthcare, I'd love to hear what you are seeing. Are you getting people breaking down the door to get these shots? Or are you surprised at how slow it is? And in general, what questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with UW Health pediatric infectious disease specialist Dr. James Conway about the COVID vaccine for young kids and infants. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Dr. Conway about these vaccines, how they work, the decision of how and when to get them? Are you a parent in this position? Do you have the appointment already, or is there something else you still want to know? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We had a call from Vicky who couldn't stay on the line, Dr. Conway. She's wondering about kids who, you know, usually maybe in those first couple few years, they're getting exposed to lots of illnesses. Their immune system is building up. Now, maybe for a lot of them, they didn't get that exposure. She's just wondering about, you know, how to take care of them, how that's going to affect their health and their risk from diseases, COVID or otherwise.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's been really tricky. We've seen outbreaks of diseases in really off-season times that we didn't expect. We had a respiratory syncytial virus outbreak last August, as you know, we just got gradually back into the beginnings of some normalcy. So we do expect that we're going to see a resurgence. We're seeing parainfluenza 3 and adenovirus currently circulating in the region. Again, not things that we usually see when we get into summer. Those are usually kind of winter months and fall. But this is going to be kind of the unpredictability of how things work. And so, you know, I think one of the things we're all learning is that we do need to be a little bit more responsible when we're sick. I think we're certainly getting employers that are more willing to actually let people truly call in sick when they have illness. And I think we're going to ask people to do that more often. You know, I think COVID may end up kind of fading into the background and just circulating continuously at some point. And so I think then it's going to be just one of the litany of viruses that knock people out and, you know, really do spread through communities. And so figuring out how we manage that all together and how often people can, you know, sort of take advantage of the ability to kind of pull themselves out of either social events or work events, I think is going to be really important. I think parents are really going to, you know, as much as it's inconvenient, have to really think about trying to keep their kids home when they're sick if they really want schools to continue to stay open and function as we'd like them to do.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Brett is with us in Middleton. Brett, hi.
Yeah, hey, good afternoon. Just a quick question. I have a four-year-old son that recently had COVID about 4 to 6 weeks ago. And my question was, what's the recommendation for getting the vaccination, or is there a a period of natural immunization provided by COVID? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, great question, Brett. And I think there's two pieces of that. You know, one, we certainly do ask people if your kid or if you are actively ill, just to try to avoid exposing the healthcare workers as well as the other folks at the offices that are giving the vaccines. So we certainly ask people to wait that full 10 days, plus make sure that all their symptoms are gone. As far as then the timing of when it's okay to get vaccinated, there's really no downside to getting vaccinated at any point then after that infection. And in fact, you know, we do anticipate that there's quite a few kids that are out there that have been infected already. And so these vaccines actually, while they may not be quite as robust an immune response as we see in adults with these lower doses, essentially these may end up acting as boosters for these kids to give them even more robust immunity than the vaccine trial showed. So I actually really encourage people whose kids have had COVID, and again, many of them have even without having been detected, that they are still going to benefit from getting vaccinated to give them sort of that much more increased immunity, especially as these variants keep changing and the immunity from the original infections doesn't seem to hold up as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brett, at 800-642-1234. Jim joins us now in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Yeah, I'm wondering if the doctor has seen any risk-benefit studies for these COVID shots for young children. My understanding is that in many countries, possibly this one also, that there's not been a healthy young child who died of COVID. And yet we see all this myocarditis, which is not a minor thing. It's about 25 or 30% of people diagnosed with myocarditis die within 6.5 years.
Jim, thanks for the call, Dr. Conway.
Yeah, a couple ways to look at that. You know, first of all, you know, with the concerns of either clots or myocarditis that we're seeing, you know, very, very rarely in vaccine recipients in the adult world, you know, we know that the risk of actually getting myocarditis from COVID infection itself is somewhere between 20 and 50 times greater than it is from the vaccine. Similar to blood clots, these viruses, as they infect people, really do knock their immune system into, you know, almost a chaotic maelstrom. And so they really do trigger clotting in people. And so the risks have really been, you know, sorted out very nicely, that the risks from the vaccines are extraordinarily low compared to the risk of the actual disease itself. I would also have to dispute what you sort of mentioned, that we've actually seen, you know, well over 400 healthy kids die from COVID here in the United States alone, where that was attributed as the cause of death. We've also seen a lot of kids die that had other complications that had underlying medical conditions, and COVID sort of set things off. So I think we really need to dispel this myth that COVID is not a big deal for kids. It certainly is unusual to have bad outcomes, but if you're kids, they don't want to have any of these outcomes if they can avoid them. The other piece of it, I think, in the cost benefit that people need to think about is that if we diminish the risk of infection and diminish the risk of ongoing transmission and shedding of virus, we actually make it that much more functional for people to continue to function in sports and schools and all those kinds of things, rather than have to get into a setting where you're going to actually have to close things down when you have outbreaks. And so I think there's additional, what we call indirect benefit, that really does need to be factored in when we make these kind of decisions.
Jim, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Dr. James Conway from UW Health, looking at COVID vaccines for kids under 5. Still time for you to call in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, I've seen some people kind of try to figure out the timing here. You mentioned earlier that there's work on variant-specific vaccines, ones that try to keep up. So people wondering whether it's for their kids or for themselves, should I get a vaccine now or hang on for a while, wait and see if I can get a more targeted vaccine to current variants? What do you say to them?
Well, for kids, I think these Omicron variant-specific vaccines are going to be quite some time. You know, we've just gotten into the emergency use authorization approvals. They're still going to have to go through, you know, ongoing monitoring and larger data collection before they're going to be able to get to the point of a full biological license being issued. Then only will they start to then look at variant vaccines for the kids. So I think for kids, you know, something's better than nothing, and what we've got right now is really what you're going to be able to get your hands on and use. And I do think it's important to think about this, especially as we get to back to school time. For adults, you know, I think more is better, and so I think that currently getting a booster, if you're in the age groups or in the medical conditions where they're recommended, I think getting one now is certainly prudent, especially as we see the Omicron BA4 and BA5 starting to really pick up quite quickly over these last couple of weeks. And then I think we'll have to sort of, you know, time will tell whether we're going to get into a further booster later in the year. I won't be surprised, but those booster variant vaccines are really just starting to kind of come to fruition at the end of their trials. So it's still going to be some time. So if you're in a group that, you know, everybody basically 5 and above is recommended to get a booster, and then everybody over 50 is recommended to get a second booster, and everybody with an underlying immunodeficiency. So wherever you are in that booster scheme, you really do need to make sure you get one as soon as you can.
In our last couple of minutes, big picture, we are in a lower level of cases in the U.S. than we have been in the not-too-distant past. Deaths and hospitalizations seem to be down. We've been here before. It sometimes comes back. What are you watching for next in the progress of this disease and in the effort to stop it?
Yeah, I think we're really looking at these mutants, these variants as they come out, to see how they continue to change, both how transmissible they are, but also how good the immunity holds up from either prior infection or prior infections and vaccines. And so I think those are the big things that we're really watching at this point. You know, I think we are starting to see again that there's fading or waning of immunity from those original vaccine series. And so we're starting to see more and more people essentially become vulnerable as that immunity fades. And so we're starting to see picking up, at least in some areas, some of these outbreaks with these variant strains. So I think that that's going to be the big thing that we watch. I think we're very encouraged by these variant-specific vaccine boosters that are coming along. I think those are going to really be a game changer when we get to that point, hopefully later this fall. But I think those are the big things that we're watching. I think the other big thing, and there's now good surveillance globally, is do we get a brand new Greek letter that pops up at some point. You know, we kind of made it through most of the Greek alphabet and then kind of got stuck at Omicron. But there's still more letters to be had, and they've actually already discussed what the further naming is going to be when we run out of Greek letters. But we do anticipate that at some point new mutants are going to show up, and then it's going to be a matter of what those do and where do they spread. Certainly society and travel has gotten back to much more close to what used to be the normal. And so I think, unfortunately, we're a little bit worried that if something does emerge, it'll spread a lot more quickly than it did earlier in the pandemic.
Dr. Conway, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Dr. James Conway, Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison and a pediatric infectious disease specialist at UW-Health. He joined us for a look at the under-5 COVID vaccine now available. You can still share your story if you're a parent of kids in this age group. Have you been eagerly waiting for this? Do you have your appointment? Let us know what's going on. Email ideas@WPR.org. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it's the 50th anniversary of Title IX, a federal effort to guarantee equal access to education for girls and women. We'll find out how it affected schools and sports tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, as we wait for the Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade, some advocates worry about the mental health consequences of not having an abortion exception for survivors of rape and incest. We'll find out why. Now, the modern pinball machine was invented way back in the 1930s, and the game stuck around, made its way into bars, restaurants, basements, and it still has a lot of fans, including our next guest. Ian Jacoby is founder and editor-in-chief of Nudge Magazine, where he writes about pinball under the name Doc Monday. He returned to his old stomping grounds at Volume 1 in Eau Claire for a look at pinball here in Wisconsin. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
When did you discover your love of pinball?
Boy, everyone kind of has this story. For me, I think it was in 2016 maybe, but whenever Game of Thrones pinball came out, it was at like a, yeah, this boy, can I say bar on like WPR?
Sure.
It feels so
weird. You can
weird.
Say bar. Yeah,
this is Wisconsin. You know, I was in a bar. I mean, and so, yeah, they had Game of Thrones pinball, and I was just playing it with my buddy Josh and got kind of just obsessed with it. And then eventually moved to Minneapolis, and I lived about 2 blocks from one of the greatest pinball places in the country called Tilt. And, yeah, from there, it was just I was hooked.
I've always enjoyed pinball. I've never been hardcore at it. I'm also terrible at it. What makes the difference between somebody who's good at pinball and somebody who's, say, me?
Honestly, I think just practice and maybe a little bit of attitude. I think you have it in you. I mean, we've just met, but yeah, I think you practice a lot. It's just something for me. It was like I used to shoot free throws a lot, you know, just by myself, and it was something that it was like, I can just zone in on this one task, you know, I don't have to think about anything else going on in my life. I can kind of just hit this ramp over and over again, and it's really satisfying. And so I think people who are really good at it, it's just kind of taken hold of them, and they practice a lot. So like anything else, I think that's what separates them.
All right, two words that come up. Nudge, the name of your pinball magazine, like you nudge the machine. You mentioned a place called Tilt, which is what happens when you nudge the machine too far. So when I've tried to do this, either I do something so minimal that it doesn't affect the motion of the ball at all, or I go too far and I tilt. Can you really control the ball by nudging the pinball machine?
Yes, you can. So what I'm going to say right now is I think even in those micro nudges, which is what I've heard them called, I know, what a term, right? But those do actually affect the ball, but I hear what you're saying. It's probably going out the out lane, so maybe that's what I would encourage you to nudge a little sooner. And so, like, for us, nudge, right, it means to – it's sort of there's a lot of meanings to nudge, right? We're sort of trying to agitate a little bit, but also, you know, you nudge someone when you know them. There's a lot of different kind of meanings to it. And I think that's kind of, you never want to treat a pinball table poorly, but you know, it is ultimately you against the machine. So I always tell people, I'm like, don't be afraid to give back a little bit. So
in your piece in Volume 1, you highlight some great places to play pinball in the Eau Claire area and some beyond in the state. What are great hot spots here in Wisconsin? Hit us with a couple.
Oh, boy. Well, one of the best in the country is this place called District 82, and it's located just outside Green Bay. They have 100 machines there, and it's kind of an all-you-can-play place, so you don't have to worry about bringing a ton of quarters. And they actually are heavily involved in IFPA, which is that's competitive pinball. So they will do all kinds of big tournaments there, but also they just have it open to the general public, and I think that's a really good place. Like, either if you have a specific game that you want to play and you just can't find it anywhere, they almost definitely have it. Or if you're just kind of looking to hang out and survey like what's going on in pinball now, that's also good. But so definitely District 82. I know there's a place in Menominee Falls called Garcade, and they have a great amount of pinball machines. But honestly, I would just encourage you, there's a website called Pinball Maps. They don't pay us or anything, but if you go on there, it will show any pinball machines that are located around you. And like, there are nerds like me who go in there and they will update it regularly. So, you know exactly what game is in there and like what condition it's in.
All right. I'm going to age myself here. I went into pinball on the Evel Knievel machine.
Oh, nice.
And then at an older age, my favorite was Pinbot. I would play either of those now if you put them in front of me. What, Ian, is, you mentioned Game of Thrones brought you in. What if I said you got to play a machine right now, what would be your go-to?
So there is one king of pinball right now, and it's Godzilla. It came out last year. It was created by this guy Keith Elwin, who basically, the way I try to explain to people is Keith Elwin is like the Michael Jordan of pinball. Like, he wins every tournament. He's been number one for like 20 years. And then he was hired by the best company or biggest company, Stern Pinball, to design tables for him. And so Godzilla is just, it's so cool. It's got like all kinds of different, you know, you're fighting monsters in it, but the flow of it is really good. It's an exciting game. It's good if you're like a beginner. You can do a lot of different things on it, but also if you get kind of more advanced, the code of the game is very, very deep. So that's by far, like, when you go on all the websites, that's the one that, like, everyone is raving about right now.
And, Ian, if somebody's out there thinking, yeah, I want to get into pinball or get back into pinball, give them a little advice for their first couple rounds.
Well, first of all, I'll say this as general life advice, be kind to yourself, right? Like, you're going out there and you're doing something, and that's good. That's kind of what I like about pinball. Whether you're good at it or bad at it, I don't think really matters. For me, it's kind of just being out there amongst people and playing, and pinball is really like a social activity. I think that's what sets it apart from video games or anything like that is, you know, you're going out somewhere. Most people don't own pinball machines because they're pretty expensive. So, you know, you're going to a bar or wherever, you know, restaurants. And yeah, that's kind of part of the fun. So I would say just people watch, have a favorite beverage, whatever that is. For me, often it's actually Diet Coke. So I can really just stay zoned in on what's going on. And then, you know, just have fun.
Ian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
That's Ian Jacoby, founder and editor-in-chief of Nudge Magazine. He wrote a recent piece for Volume 1 Magazine in Eau Claire about pinball, past, present, and future, and what's going on around Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin audience question about Rib Mountain.
There's a rumor that Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin is an extinct volcano. It seems somewhat reasonable. You can see it from miles away, and there are volcanic rocks all over the city of Wausau. Well, it's not. It never was. And although it does have ties to ancient volcanoes, the star of Rib Mountain's story is a rock too tough to break. Liz Domes Harder brings us the story.
You could say Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin has stood the test of time. I'm not talking about its ski hill that has been open since 1937, nor the state park that's been there for almost a century. I'm talking about something much older.
The rock that makes up Rib Mountain is called quartzite. It's a very, very hard rock, one of the hardest on Earth, and it's estimated to be about 1.7 billion years old.
That's Scott Spoolman, a science writer who lives in Madison and literally wrote the book on Wisconsin's rocks called, well, Wisconsin Rocks.
That's 1,700 million or 17 million centuries old.
So this stuff lasts. But where did it come from? Mark Janowiak from New Glarus has wondered a lot about that.
You know, I'm a Wikipedia expert on Rib Mountain, so I learned, three things about it.
Janowiak and I both grew up near Rib Mountain and spent plenty of winters skiing its slopes. He sent in a few questions to Wisconsin about Rib Mountain, and they got me curious, too.
Is Rib Mountain volcanic in origin? How big was the, if it is, how big is the, like, the volcanic range?
There were four volcanoes in the Wausau area 1.8 billion years ago, explains Lisa Siewert. She's a senior lecturer of geography and geology at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. But Rib Mountain wasn't one of those volcanoes. It was the hard rock underneath one of them.
Underneath volcanoes are magma chambers, and those magma chambers brought up a bunch of this super-duper hard rock that we call quartzite.
Spoolman explains where that came from.
It's originally sandstone. It's ancient sandstone, and it was deposited by ancient seas, and then it was eventually buried under other sediments and then mashed by continental collisions that caused unimaginable heat and pressure and metamorphosed that sandstone into the very hard rock called quartzite.
We can get a sense of how big the volcano was. In the footprint of one of those old volcanoes are three quartzite blobs: Hardwood Hill, Mosinee Hill, and of course, Rib Mountain.
Think of the size of Rib Mountain. That is a quartzite blob.
Keith Montgomery has some good analogies. He's a retired geography and geology professor who lives in Wausau.
You can think that the mountains that existed here would have been similar to Mount Rainier or Mount Baker, those kinds of mountains. So several thousand feet, maybe 10,000 feet above the local terrain.
For comparison, Rib Mountain is 650 feet above the local terrain. The mountain range that stretched across the upper Midwest and into Canada quickly eroded away. Spoolman explains.
There were no plants or animals, so everything was eroding almost as fast as it was growing.
Still, weathering was no match for Rib Mountain's quartzite. But what about glaciers? Janowiak had a question about that, too.
Because one thing I read is the glaciers kind of went around it. It didn't go over the top. Or did it go over the top?
There's been four major glaciations in the last million years or so. And pretty likely that three of those four did cross over Rib Mountain.
The most recent glacier stopped short of the mountain. The other three before it might have scraped off some chunks. Lucky for those of us who enjoy the mountain, that quartzite is one tough rock.
WPR's Liz Domes Harder brought us that story on Rib Mountain. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll hear from a Wisconsin-based sexual assault survivor advocate who will walk us through some of the mental health concerns women considering an abortion may face after surviving rape or incest. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. A leaked draft of a U.S. Supreme Court opinion that would overturn Roe v. Wade is bringing up questions about different situations that women might face if they're seeking an abortion, including the idea of having abortion exceptions for survivors of rape and incest. According to an article from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, some pro-life advocates say that an abortion exception for rape and incest would only further perpetuate a cycle of violence. But the majority of the U.S. population has shown support of those exceptions. Kelly Molitke is the Associate Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Kelly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, rape and incest is traumatic to begin with. Can you talk about some of the mental health concerns you have if abortion access is restricted to people who have already survived that?
Yeah, of course. The trauma of sexual assault impacts survivors in lots of different ways. Similarly, mental health issues are complex, and survivors respond differently and have different mental health needs afterwards. Yet, it's important to remember that through this trauma, right, survivors are not broken. They are surviving and thriving in ways that are best for them. And ultimately, they should be trusted and empowered to make important decisions about their physical and mental health. And when they are given those decisions, including making decisions about their body, it helps them to regain some of the control that they've lost after an assault.
Sometimes I think exceptions in cases of rape or incest are seen as a middle ground, but I know there are concerns that, okay, if you're looking to get an abortion using those exceptions, you then have to, prove that you are a survivor of rape or incest. Can you talk about how that might work on a practical level?
Yeah, that's where things get really, really tricky. And while we understand the inclination and in some ways like appreciate that there's a thoughtfulness around survivors in this discussion, these exceptions are not something that WCASA supports for a lot of reasons. And, you know, first of all, abortion access and choice are about the autonomy and authority a person has over their own body. And these concepts are also foundational to sexual violence prevention. Individuals need to have decision-making authority over their bodies, whether it's the choice to participate in sexual activity, to use birth control, or to terminate a pregnancy. And any restrictions to this autonomy, particularly state-sanctioned restrictions, sends the message that your body is not your own. And that brings us to, you know, it's also important to think about the implementation, which is the part you were getting to, and who gets to decide? How do they decide? What evidence is needed, right? And let's face it, proving sexual assault has rarely gone well for survivors, regardless of the system we're talking about. Oftentimes, these exceptions require a report to law enforcement, something we know the vast majority of survivors don't want to do. And furthermore, it puts an additional burden on marginalized communities who have been harmed by the very systems now charged with making this decision.
We are talking to Kelly Molitke, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, looking at the potential end of Roe v. Wade and protections for people seeking abortions, the impact that could have, particularly on people who have survived rape or incest. Kelly, I mentioned that leaked Supreme Court document, an actual ruling. We don't know what it will be, but an actual ruling expected to come out probably in the next week and a half or so. Assuming it did overturn Roe v. Wade, this Wisconsin 1849 law would come into effect, restricting abortion, except in some cases where there's a threat to the life of the mother. What are your concerns if that happens, that sequence of events happens, for the well-being, the mental well-being of the people you work with at the coalition?
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked about a little bit already about the impact, right? Like, how does this play out? There's not a system in place for this, and we don't want to create a new system that is to validate claims, you know, of rape in order to access abortion. And we also have to remember that with any bans or exceptions comes enforcement. And as states criminalize abortion, individuals will be investigated for their private medical decisions and are more likely to be criminalized for these decisions. And we know how criminalization works, right? We've seen it in many different ways. And the racial injustices of the criminal legal system are well documented. These laws will target and disproportionately impact people of color. They're going to target and harm survivors. We're very concerned about the implications of this Supreme Court decision.
Again, if this law takes effect, resumes effect here in Wisconsin after the potential end of Roe v. Wade, there wouldn't be that exception for rape or incest in Wisconsin. How are you planning when it comes to dealing with the mental and emotional needs that might create for the survivors you work with?
Yeah, survivors need, you know, actually survivors deserve the full range of decisions related to their medical concerns after an assault. And survivors often have a lot of medical concerns after a rape. And one thing we try to do is offer survivors ways to regain some of the control lost after that assault. And if abortion isn't one of those options, especially for a survivor who is pregnant, that's another loss of control and additional trauma that person's going to have to experience. And I ask folks to imagine this, right? Like imagine you've just experienced, you know, a really traumatic event like a rape, and you're seeking ways to regain some sense of control, to navigate how to move forward. And then you find out in the midst of all of that trauma that you're pregnant and live in a state where abortion is illegal, which is what we're facing here in Wisconsin. And again, you find yourself completely out of control over what happens to your body. And this time by a state sanctioned law, that you have even less control over. And I, you know, we're really, you know, we're trying to help advocates figure out how to support survivors through this, but we're struggling too. It's really hard to imagine, and it's going to be really difficult for survivors and advocates to navigate.
Before or after that ruling comes down, for someone who is a survivor, what resources would you point them toward to seek help? And here I'm not just talking about abortion, but to deal with all the issues that are coming from that.
Yeah, it's important for survivors to know that that we see you, we believe you, and there's lots of people out there to provide support. And that support exists in counties all across the state. People can go to WCASA's website, which is WCASA.org, and hit the Get Help button and find out what services are available. And advocates are available to support survivors with any decisions that they're facing. And help them process the trauma that they've experienced.
In just our last minute or so, what are you watching for? What are you getting ready for now over this, what could be the last week of Roe v. Wade?
Gosh, again, we're just trying to engage with partners in the reproductive health world. We're talking to advocates to help prepare them for the role of an advocate is to help survivors process decisions and to give them their options. And we're taking away a really big option for survivors. And so we want to help prepare advocates in having that conversation with survivors, as well as identifying how to eliminate barriers. That's another important role an advocate plays, is eliminating barriers. So it's going to be finding access in other places and helping them process this significant barrier that they now face.
Kelly, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for having this important conversation.
Kelly Mo Litke is the Associate Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. She was with us today to talk about possible mental health implications for survivors of rape or incest who would be looking for an abortion, specifically if Roe v. Wade were to be overturned, as seems very possible, a decision awaited from the U.S. Supreme Court, possibly this week or in the next week after that, and that would trigger a Wisconsin law from 1849 effectively banning all abortion except some circumstances to save the life of a mother. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the congressional panel investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol hold its next public hearing. Join the Ideas Network tomorrow afternoon at 2. We'll have live NPR coverage, the actual broadcast from the U.S. House Committee with analysis from NPR. That'll start at 2 here on Wisconsin Public Radio, or you could stream online with the Wisconsin Public Radio app or at WPR.org. Then, depending on how timing shakes out, we'll bring you some analysis of that, of tomorrow's testimony and hearings and witnesses. That'll come up tomorrow here on Central Time, again, depending on how long that goes. Watch for coverage of the January 6th Commission. That's tomorrow afternoon here on the Ideas Network.